The EMS Garage.
Okay, I got DC on the phone. They want to know if you can handle that call as well. Just confirming you are checking the patient.
Paramedic 22 is on scene.
The EMS Garage for September 26, 2008. This is Episode 3, The Rabid Raccoon. This week featuring Roger Coit, Will Dunn, Dr. Dave Ross, Matt Solomon, Ben Dengerink, and I'm your host, Chris Montera. Now let's get on with the show.
In the top 100 for medical podcasts on iTunes this week. So it's good. It's good, yeah. So this week I have a great panel. I have Will Dunn, Roger Coit, Dave Ross, and Ben, I can never say your last name, so that's what we're going to call you. sorry, Ben. Hey, and I've got Matt Solomon coming on, too, so I'll add him on here. Hey, Will, tell us who you are and where you're from.
Will Dunn, I'm the clinical supervisor at Eagle County Ambulance in Vail, Colorado.
Excellent. And Roger Coit.
Can we talk now?
I'll let you talk, I guess, yeah. I've unmuted you.
Hi. Hi, everyone. How are you?
In your nice radio voice.
I can do it all night long.
Roger.
Yes.
Hi. Ah, who are you? Oh, wait, you wanted me to call you Harry. Is it Harry Dent? Dent Harry?
It's my new stage name.
Just hear Harry Dentary.
Oh, Matt Solomon's there. Except I can hear myself in the background of his computer, which is really nice.
Sorry, is that better?
Headphones. Yeah, that's much better, dude. Thanks.
Yay.
Hey, and Matt Solomon, who are you and where are you from?
My name is Matt Solomon, and I work for Chris Montera.
Oh, don't claim that. Don't claim that.
Huh?
Don't claim that, dude.
Oh yeah, I was taught by Will Dunn.
Oh, there you can.
You should claim that either.
You should claim that. I would definitely claim that. And then Dave Ross.
Yep, I'm from Colorado Springs, Colorado.
Our excellent medical director and always good person with advice. And then Ben, I'm gonna say your name right. Dennerink.
Yeah.
Don't pronounce the K.
I'm close. Dinnering?
Yeah. No, that's...
Dingering.
You're getting warmer.
Gosh! I'm going to get it. I'll get it one of these weeks, I promise. Say it for me again.
It's Dingering.
Ah, Dingering. Dingering! You do say the K.
Yeah, but it's kind of like a soft K.
Okay.
It's like a soft C.
It's a great show. Hey, Will, tell us what you were talking about before, the Florida doc.
Yeah, I think this is a great forum, and I think that we're especially lucky to have Dave Ross, who is a very progressive medical director, but also one who is very involved in the state, at least in Colorado. And I saw an article today out of Collier County, Florida, which is on the southwest side of Florida. And it looks like there's a new medical director by the name of Bob Tober, who has instituted what are some fairly controversial things in that county. It sounds like to me, and I don't know that much about Collier County or their system, but it looks like a two-tier system with ALS fire response as well as ALS transport, and it looks like two different agencies. Don't quote me on that because I don't know for sure. But I got my start in EMS in Florida, believe it or not. And that's how they do it in Pinellas County. But what's interesting is that in the Naples Fire Department, Dr. Tober pulled all ALS meds off the fire engines because the city firefighters there had failed some certification tests. And I don't know if that was medical director specific or if that was state certification. I'm going to guess it was just with the county. That was last week, and then this week he ended up pulling off a number of ALS medications off other county fire trucks. So I guess my question is to Dr. Ross, what is your comfort level with the many paramedics that practice using your license, and is this a reasonable action from a medical director to essentially limit the practice of state-certified paramedics that are part of his license?
Well, I don't know anything about this story other than what you just told me there, Will, so I'll plead ignorance. But I think in concept, well, this sounds pretty drastic, it's not beyond the realm of possibility. And in our own system, and I have, the AMR agency in Colorado Springs, which is a big service, and then I have a variety of smaller services. Some are all BLS, some are a mix of ALS and BLS. But we have a variety of agencies. And what I've generally found is, my experience has been that I'll occasionally find a paramedic who I just don't think is really up to par and where I want them to be. And at that point in time, we'll limit their practice in some way, shape, or form. And it may be that, we put them back in remediation or a field instructor program to work on some things, or perhaps they've gone through that, and I just don't think that they're going to be able to cut it on a par with the others. And if we have the capability, we'll offer them an EMT slot if we think they have value to the service in some other way. But they're
well,
not going to be
well practicing. within the bounds of state statute.
Right.
The medical director can limit the scope of practice of any of their EMTs.
Right, and we've done that, and in various phases at different times and different agencies. But I guess I would really be worried if it sounds like this particular guy in Florida has been concerned enough, right, wrong, or indifferent, with more than just one paramedic. It sounds like it's perhaps more of a system issue, and they're making changes in terms of what that whole service can do. And I've never had that situation. Having said that, I guess we could, and I might have to at some point in time, but we've never had that situation where in my practices where our agencies have really, as a group, not been able to cut it. It's usually an individual thing.
Dave, have you ever one of the things with a paramedic in one of the ways you can limit their scope of practice or provide a greater degree of oversight is to require what might typically be standing order protocols for a paramedic and require them to use base contact.
Have I ever done that? Not
yeah.
Normally. Actually, in our systems in the Teller County and El Paso County area, over the years, one of the things that I was able to change is to go from a pretty much a call-in situation for any drug administration short of oxygen and an IV. We used to be call-in for everything, and we've really gone away from that in our system, and it's almost all standing order. So I would say that I've never had this happen specifically, Roger, but if I had a paramedic that I really didn't think I could trust in the standing order environment, if I had that situation, I don't think I would ever conceive of a situation where I'd make them call in where everybody else is using standing orders. I would be looking at all aspects of their practice and trying to figure out if
yeah.
they could really flourish.
100% review would be a good alternative of all their cases.
Or with a field instructor. So I got a yeah. question for you, Dr. Ross. Do you know offhand what drugs are call-in? You said you're almost all standing order, and I guess
right.
as a paramedic, I appreciate that. But what do you have as your call-ins? I'm just curious.
Well, yeah, without looking at it, the one that jumps to mind in our system is dopamine in a non-post cardiac arrest situation. So somebody who's hypotensive that has failed fluid bolus and never lost their pulse and requires a pressor, and it's dopamine, which is what we carry, that in our system is a call. And the other thing that's a call in typically is charcoal by NG tube. Not PO charcoal, but NG tube charcoal.
Still gross and messy. Still gross and messy.
Yeah.
You don't get a lot of calls for that one, I'm guessing.
No, and especially since we have sorbitol on top of it. So if you're not a big fan of diarrhea, you don't want sorbitol and charcoal. And so we don't get a lot of requests for that, but occasionally we do. And those are the two that come to mind. I'm sure there's a couple that I'm forgetting, Roger, but there might be one or two others, but that's about it.
But I think that's very reasonable, and I think that if you've got a system where all the components for protocol training and call review and QA are in place, you know, I think it's reasonable that you're limiting kind of, you know, the drugs that are, I don't want to say once in a lifetime, but I think I was a medic in a city system running thousands of calls a year and probably have given dopamine half dozen times. So right. I can appreciate the call in on something like that. It's interesting to me that in this system in Collier County that they just, you know, this medical director took what I thought was a fairly abrupt action, just removing the medication. So they took away the option, whatever. But I appreciate your comment on what to do in trying to get paramedics to a point where they're competent and practicing in a method that is consistent with the standards in your county, and I appreciate your comments.
Yeah, and I think, Will, just one other thing, that as I'm listening to this, part of what I do is really political, and so you, in addition to trying to assure, you know, the quality and the training and QA and everything, it's really political, and so, you know, for every big action that you take as a manager or as a medical director or whatever, you know, there's some side effects to that, and so I would view the pulling of drugs or some sort of equipment that's already on board and has been used as a pretty drastic step, and so there's going to be some follow-up for that. And if really people are unsafe and you really think that's the case, well, then maybe it is in the best interest of the patient, but it sounds to me like there's really a training issue.
Public outcry.
Yeah. Well, like, take Florida, for example, in another scenario where, you know, a few years ago when they did the Orlando study and found supposedly that 25% of the endotracheal tubes that they placed were either in the esophagus or somewhere else other than the trachea.
They all just got lost right as they were moving the patient to the bed.
Exactly. They slipped out.
I swear.
I know it was in. I saw it pass by the cords.
Pass by the cords in the general area.
So if you were in that system, you know you've got a lot of problems, and the question is whether you want to respond to that by eliminating all innovations, which some people have talked about doing, not just in Florida. You want to eliminate all innovations, and that's the answer, or whether it's really an oversight problem and a training problem, and you can fix that. And, you know, philosophically, you could look at it two different ways. But if you pull endotracheal innovation from an ALS service, I mean, there's going to be some fallout without a doubt.
We've talked about that with our service. Just discussing possibilities and low probability. And one of the things, right or wrong, that you come up with is, besides all the other obvious issues, another less obvious issue is providers with your agency might be quite upset to be disallowed from that skill, acknowledging all the other reasons. But for another reason is that they would no longer have that on their resume if they were to leave and go to another agency that does do endotracheal innovation.
You know, and I think Dr. Rosh, you're referring to the CAT study that was in Annals of Emergency Medicine in 2001.
Yeah, that's it.
And what that was like, I believe, out of Orange County, Florida. You know, and odd that you mentioned that. The Collier County article that I was reading today, and it was, I believe, a newspaper article, didn't mention actually removing all the ALS skills. So that's a good question. I'm wondering if they were providing innovation, if they're still doing that but not having any medications. You know, Well, that's a fine line in trying to define where, which service, where you're comfortable with your paramedic still doing that. And I don't know anything about this particular community if those paramedics that were first response ALS were getting the skills maintenance that they needed to retain intubation skills. So let me throw this out to everybody on the call. What do you regard as the minimum acceptable percentage for intubation success rates?
I already know where you're going with this, and I'm
going
to stay out of it.
I'm not going anywhere.
Okay, Will, you could frame the discussion from at this point is, what are the success rates for anesthesiologists? Or what are the success rates for ER physicians?
What is EMS to be reasonable?
I'm just listening to you guys. I'm learning from you guys right now.
What's your success rate, Dave?
About 100%.
Yeah.
I'll just say that anesthesia and emergency department success rates are colored in part by the fact that they use a lot of drugs, which generally can help you and should help you. So. I don't know the overall success rate, but I would bet it's in the mid to high 90% rate for anesthesia in the ER.
And so I ask to frame the question as it's extrapolated to field providers. Typically without the medications, most systems I hope are not using. and then the field environment, the environmental conditions, typically the ER and certainly the operating theater is well lighted, quiet and calm generally. So I think you have to factor that into any anticipated success rate. Excuse me.
So what do we call as, you know, this was something on one of the EMS research groups that raged for weeks. It was acceptable IV success rates. What do we think is acceptable intubation success rates either as an individual or as an agency?
Well, can I?
You know, here's a question. Just a question for you. Cause it, you know, I'm being an intermediate that's going through a paramedic internship right now. I actually had this discussion with one of my preceptors last night, and his answer was statistics are a joke because they don't factor in situation. They don't factor in exactly what's going on. They don't factor in the two-hour-long IV slump I'm in right now. Sorry for the sidebar, but they don't factor in all the various things. And speaking from that standpoint, it's hard to say. And then speaking from the sociological standpoint, which was my major in college, is statistics are whatever you make them. Are you looking for this in this scenario? Or are you just looking for total, you know, endotracheal intubations and compared directly with your anesthesiologist in the hospital environment? I mean, it's a difficult question, I'd say, to answer straight up, you know?
So, Matt, you're one of those guys that would take what Mark Twain once said, that there's lies, there's damn lies.
Damn lies.
Statistics, yes. I love it.
But
it's great.
I think that regardless if you are an administrator or you're a medical director or you're a general manager or you're a chief
you
or whoever
attention.
You are, you got to pay attention to something. And if
I think you want to see is 95 or 100%, you know?
I'd love to see that. But I would love to see a 100% success rate in intubations, and I know that that's a fantasy. So my question is, here ultimately is where I'm going. At what point do we say, you know what, we're not going to be successful the majority of the time we're going to do this procedure, we need to pull it?
Well, can I just offer a couple of things? And I would differ a little bit in, I think we need to have a healthy skepticism for statistics. Having said that, especially when it comes to intubation, there is actually some information there. And we all should remember that the state is gathering NEMSIS data, the 64 or so, whatever number of data points there are for transportation agencies is being inputted or should be in most transport agencies now. So at some point in time when they access all of that, we will have probably some fairly representative numbers of oral and nasal intubations, with or without medication. I was just going to say, having said that, one of the benefits of being associated with AMR is noting my own statistics in our agency, which we average about 40,000 transports a year. So I know the numbers for us, and I also know the numbers for national AMR. And in general, across the board, all comers, no medication, oral intubation success rate is about 84%, 83-84%. But what we also should know is that, and I think this is true, is that the nasal intubation success rate is somewhere around 65% or 70%. So that's fairly reproducible, fairly factual. The outliers to some of that is, how many attempts, especially when we look at AMR national data, how many attempts is that? And in our system, we're limited to 3 attempts in the Colorado Springs area. So we count any attempt within that 3 attempts as being successful. So,
but Dave, do you have a backup airway like a King or a?
We have a combi tube
LMA.
We have the combi tube, and our fire department, Colorado Springs Fire Department, uses actually the LMA fire, the fast track, and a patient that's within the Colorado Springs city limits may get either a bag valve mask, they may get a combi tube, they might get an LMA fast track, depends. We have one of those couple of choices.
So here's the question, because Will and I talked about this the other day. Here's the question I asked him. I said, should we be worried about how often we do it, or should we be worried about the gold standard is airway management? And good airway management can be BLS care. And sure. BLS care is good oxygenation, good airway management. And you don't have to stick a tube in the throat to make sure that's achieved. Right. And maybe I'm crazy, but I think that's the gold standard.
Well, I think you are crazy, but I agree with you.
Okay, good. At least somebody thinks I'm crazy.
Dave, share with us, I imagine being privy with the AMR national data set.
Yeah.
Any ideas on provider experience and provider proficiency in intubation success rate?
No one knows that. We've actually looked at the literature pretty carefully there. And from an academic standpoint, I don't think there's an answer out there. Interestingly enough, National AMR has tried to answer the question, and they've looked at a hodgepodge of literature, and they've tried to extrapolate back from anesthesia literature, and they've kind of come up, although this is not proven, they've come up with the idea that probably 10 either real or simulated intubations a year is probably where most people plateau out at a quality level.
Interesting. When I was the clinical director for PrideMark Paramedics, we looked at our paramedics data, and what we noticed was that once the paramedic got through about the first 10 intubations, the first 10 were an adventure, but then they would plateau out, and we would have an idea with the next 10 on where they were. And if most of the time they would be in the 85 to 90% range, and we knew that if we had somebody that was lower than that we had somebody that was a problem. So that's interesting that number 10 keeps coming up.
Yeah,
the magic number.
Do you set a 10 intubation requirement annually?
Yeah.
So if the medics aren't getting tubes in the field, do you send them to the OR to get 10 tubes?
No, we've given up on the OR as a consistent
Can't
source.
Do it. Can't yeah. do it.
Right.
Impossible.
That's right.
For any agency with a significant number of providers, there's just not enough opportunity. A lot of in the OR, they're intubating less and less. Correct me if I'm wrong.
That's exactly right.
They're doing LMA now.
Well, for short cases, they sure are. And so you cannot really depend on the OR. The almost all now are going to be done through simulation, like it or not. Now, we occasionally may be able to send a problem medic into the OR and get a couple, maybe.
Yeah.
But on any consistent basis, I completely agree with that. It's simulation, and so how much of a decrement that is versus the live patient, I don't know. It's probably some, but most of your intubation. So we mandate 10 per medic per year, simulated patients.
Live or rubber?
Oh, either way, any of them. Yep. Any one of the combination is acceptable. But, I mean, I honestly really can't tell you whether 8 is good or 11 is better or, you know, and it really does vary a whole lot by medic, too, to some degree. But
Dave, I was trying to set you up in my earlier question. I've heard some rumors that AMR might be getting close because of the bulk of their data and the attempts versus success rate per year, their experiences versus success rate.
They've got freaking 5 million calls in the database. I think they could make some conclusions.
Yes, and I think that maybe somebody will hear that.
Well, they would. Their problem is, and I've talked to Scott Bourne about this a little bit, and who's the national clinical coordinator, their problem is they do have a ton of data, but from a pre-hypothesized study standpoint, which is what you kind of start out with when you're doing a scientific study, they really don't have that. So their problem is they have lots of data coming in, but they don't have a real peer-reviewed scientific study construct to analyze it in. So it's useful, but it's not as clean as it could be for publication.
Okay.
Dave, one other quick question for you with your system. You had mentioned, I think you had said 3 intubation attempts. So is it a mandate that 3 endotracheal tube attempts and then you go with the backup airway? Is that the setup?
No. Well, what we say is we put a cap on 3 attempts. And an attempt in our system is defined as a blade in the mouth with intent to intubate. And they don't have to take 3 attempts. In other words, if you get in there and on your first or second attempt, you go, geez, there's all kinds of obstructions or whatever. I'm not going to get this. You know, I'm going to give up. You don't have to go to 3. It's just up to 3. Because we were, prior to that, having at times people, you know, documenting dutifully 8 or 9 attempts. Now, I don't know what really happens.
My goodness. You know, Denver, Dr. Caldwell out of Denver Health, and I was privileged to be on this study that was published kind of actually in direct response to the JAMA paper, the CATS paper, notice that after about 3 attempts, you're pretty much, your success rate after 3 is way down. I think Dr. Caldwell, at least at one point, based on that data, espoused 2 attempts per experienced provider. And in the Denver system where they're running dual paramedics, it was 2 for the attendant, 2 for the driver, and then come up with a different plan.
Right.
Well, Dave, the finish of my question was, after 3, can they use one of the a rescue airway or the King airway or their combi tube or the fast track?
Yeah, I mean, yes,
and are they supposed? So they are mandated to go to that. Now, can they start with this backup airway?
They can if they're BLS, and they have that option. Most paramedics don't. I mean, I don't insist that they have to go with an intubation.
Great.
First, but they don't. Most don't. I will just tell you. But if we have an EMT that's on like a standby or something, and they're by themselves, they will. And they don't have to go to 3 attempts. They can go to 1, and we've had that. We just had a recent save. We have them periodically with the backup airway. You know, people are resuscitating and walk out of the hospital, and then maybe they were going to be anyway. But every once in a while, somebody actually does survive, you know, associated with a backup airway in a cardiac arrest circumstance.
Okay. Yeah, we added the King airway, I guess, about a year ago after studying our success rates and evaluating a backup airway, which is is kind of a misnomer for us. We added it to the armamentarium of procedures and equipment and trained folks and said, you pick your tool, either one.
I think that's fair. How often do you use it, Roger?
Me, never. I check email, but the guys who actually do medicine out in the field.
How often does your agency use it?
It's become much more common. I'd say at least 50% of the time we manage an airway, it's with the King airway, and if not more. We're fixing to do a follow-up study.
So what happens in the event, Roger, if you know, one of your medics or an I or whatever puts in a King and along comes a flight nurse or you know, somebody else, what happens with that? Do they remove it just because they should be able to get in their mind?
We haven't encountered that, actually. I think we've had one example of that and they kept it. So we haven't It hasn't become an issue, although I could see it would be. Are you still a medical director for a flight program, Dave?
Not anymore. But anyway, when I was there, our instruction was if it's ventilating and working, leave it in.
Leave it. Well, that just makes sense, doesn't it?
Yay, that's
given
good.
Given the environment and the chances that you won't get it back in
right.
without a struggle.
And we have that, you know, with some of our rural fire departments out here. You know, if AMR or one of our Teller County agencies responds, which they often do, you know, to a rural fire, and they've all got a combi tube or a King or whatever it is, and if that's in and it's working, the medics are instructed
good to go.
To leave alone. And we've actually had that happen on a few occasions.
Well, we've been very happy with the King Airway as a little side plug. Really happy. We did a study an internal study on success rates before we added them, and it's been about a year, and I'm fixing to hopefully run the data again and see what kind of success rate we've had, what kind of use rate we've had with it.
Yeah, it's a good device, no question.
Roger, have you noticed any issues with the King Airways at all?
One call, our provider, I think they had an endotracheal tube intubation attempt and a King Airway intubation attempt. The guy was sound like a tough patient in general. It was a bit of a struggle, and they ended up placing the King with direct laryngoscopy and were successful with that. So that was a complication or a problem, but it worked out well in the end.
Just curious.
At the end of the ski season, we've yet to have a use. I think we've had, a half dozen or so cardiac arrests since then, but we've, knock on wood, we've been successful with first pass intubation for all those cardiac arrests since we put them on. So we haven't had a use yet.
Well, let's move it along a little bit. I just wanted to... I have a couple more studies and other things from the internet this week anyway. That was a really good topic. Holy cow. I was also hesitant about bringing up the GlideScope, but we'll do that another time, Will. I know you wanted to bring that up, but...
I was not going to bring that up.
I know. Yeah. I'm stoking the fire for next time.
I have an opinion.
I know you do. I know you do.
No.
You never have an opinion, Will.
And Chris, just to let you know, we've used it in RED, so I'd be happy to chime in at some point.
Oh, here we go.
Excellent. No. Let's stoke the fire next time. That's $10,000 worth of equipment that Will's going
to
spend $78,000 on.
Stay
anyway, next.
The next episode of EMS Garage.
Hey, I'm going to use you. You have a great voice. Hey, I just sent you guys a link to Dispatch. It's the Columbus Dispatch, and it was an interesting article this week. The state EMS office in Ohio, just to give you guys a quick update, will not release the call times from their state database, stating that it is privileged information and that, quite frankly, the State Fire Association doesn't need to know. Okay. Well... in comes the NFPA, and
who?
The NFPA, the National Fire Protection Association, National Fire Protection Association. Yeah. Carl Peterson said, "Hey, somebody's got mail." Yeah. That paramedics should strive to arrive. I cannot talk tonight. Paramedics should strive to arrive within 6 minutes of an emergency call. That is bunk. And I just want to start the whole process right here, that here you have all these fire chiefs saying that people are dying if it's an emergency call, that 5 minutes and 54 seconds should be really the gold standard. We should add more paramedics to the system because people are dying.
Can I open another can of worms and say they're fire chiefs?
Dr. Pons, actually, out of Denver Health Medical Center,
debunked it,
and debunked it in an article that I believe was published in Academic Emergency Medicine probably 10 years ago. And right. I'll see if I can find it, but I think they looked. There was a number of things that Dr. Pons looked at, and that was either the 6 minute or 8 minute, and I can't remember what that.
That was the 8:59. 8:59.
There is no, there is nothing. There's no scientific data behind that.
It's garbage, but they're using fear and they're using intimidation that says, hey, people are dying. Wouldn't you want somebody there in 6 minutes? I mean, 8 minutes is too long. That's crazy.
Would you rather have a paramedic that runs one call a week there in 6 minutes or a paramedic that runs 10 calls a day there in 12?
Oh, I agree. I agree completely. And I know Tim Erskine from when we worked on the national data set together. And he actually was the president of the National EMS Data Association, and he's quoted in the article. But basically, I think we're all in agreement here. They're crazy, but maybe you guys have a different opinion, but it doesn't sound that way.
I agree with you.
What are y'all's thoughts along those same lines of running emergent versus non-emergent?
Oh, I've got an article on that, too.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I think
what are your thoughts on being there in 6 minutes with lights and sirens for, you know, a medical call that could possibly be a BLS, or get there in 8 minutes with no lights, no sirens, but much safer?
I mean, that's an interesting question, Matt. I think that we're probably getting better with priority dispatching and trying to figure those things out. But that's a tough question. I think that once somebody has decided that it's a true emergency, it makes sense to safely drive emergently to that call. But I tell you, all of us have gone on calls with lights and siren that probably didn't warrant it.
I think that the thing to keep in mind in all of this is that from a legal liability standpoint, depending on what statistics you believe, it's somewhere between 10 and 35 times more likely that an agency is going to get sued for a motor vehicle crash that they're involved in than they are from a medical malpractice issue.
Yep.
So your crash, which is much more likely to happen, is also much more likely to result in a suit, if that makes any difference to anybody.
That in rapid sequence induction, huh?
I don't know anything about that.
Oh man, now you're just really trying to stoke the fire.
I'm trying to mix topics.
That's good.
And I know you are.
Well, it's pretty good that Matt brought that up, because that's actually a great segue to ambulance safety, and a great segue to the last article I was going to talk about this week. It was in eScience News, and it was a study published in the Journal of American Medical Association, September 24th. Study findings help EMS respond to cardiac emergencies more safely and efficiently. Basically, what it's saying is that, you know, we don't need to run emergent to a lot of things. And in fact, if they're going to die, we don't even want you bringing them back to the hospital. I don't know if you guys had a chance to read that article or not.
I have not seen that.
Doesn't make a difference. So, Chris, tell me, in your system... Chris, tell me, in your system, do you use medical priority dispatching?
Not yet, no.
So do you have selective response guidelines for your providers based on what
the dispatch information is?
So do you respond emergent to unknown injury accidents?
Negative.
How about CPR in progress?
CPR in progress, yes.
You bet.
I mean, it just makes sense. It's so easy.
How about a rabid raccoon bite?
No.
No, not emergent? That doesn't get
no,
by.
Oh, man, if I have to get there next week, I'll let you know. No, I'm teasing. Well, I'm teasing.
There's no rabies vaccine anyway, so there's
that's
no
right.
rush. But
isn't there a breakout? Isn't there a recent breakout of rabid raccoons in the state, too, I was hearing, Dave?
There is, but there's a very limited supply of rabies vaccine, which is a problem.
So you're hosed. Host.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you might be able to get it for that, but you know, if a unvaccinated dog bit you, no, you can forget it. But Chris, are you not? You guys are also. You may not be, using medical priority dispatch on the front end, but you guys do have a limiter coming back on the back end on the return to the hospital, do you not?
Yeah, there's very, 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 very few things will run emergent back to the hospital. And in fact, most of the time I tell the crews, you know, you're going to be running 70 down the interstate anyway to the nearest hospital, which is 30 minutes away either way. So I don't know what the lights and siren are going to gain you unless it's severe traffic or things like that. Now, I leave that up
with you on that, Chris. I think that there is a difference between prioritizing your patient as an emergent patient versus the operational decision to run lights and siren as a return. I really feel strongly that if you have a sick patient in the back,
okay,
and you elect not to run back and not to endorse on that trip sheet that you're taking an emergent return, that there is potentially somebody could come after you for that. But there's nothing, I don't think there's any correlation between whether you're using lights or siren or not.
And that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that they can still run 70 miles an hour down the highway at the, you know, doing the same thing. Now, turning the lights on or not is not going to affect the way they're driving, only from a mental status and from a mental standpoint of the driver and the other drivers around them. And I think that if we're going to truly talk about safety and we're going to talk about those issues, that is a huge key in my mind that we have to look at, not only the way the way we look at patients, that, you know, most of the time our thought of sick isn't really sick. You know, we get to the ER and they go, all right, get them in number 9 and we'll be back there in 20 minutes.
Because you based your judgment on mechanism of injury.
Well, not even.
Why, sorry. I had to throw that one in there. Hey, Bill.
Yay. I agree.
You know, you can write on your trip sheet anytime you want that you return to emergency.
How many times have you done that? How many times have you put this was an emergent return and poked your head up front and said, hey, tell them you're going back emergency, don't turn any lights on?
Why would you say that?
Because it tells them it's the bat signal of I've got a sick patient in the back.
Then you call the hospital and say, hey, we're coming in.
Back in emergent.
Yes.
But I'm telling my driver, whoever's driving, hey, just go back. Just don't turn any lights on. Don't turn the siren on. Follow all the laws. Do everything you would be if you're in your normal car. Tell them you're going back emergently.
Yep. Hey, okay. And Will, is emergently a word?
No, it's not. It isn't a word. That's a good thing. But if I say code 10, nobody understands what I'm saying.
I know exactly what you mean. Sorry.
Well, I'm going to keep my opinion to myself on this part of the conversation since my boss is on the phone.
Hey, you know what? I'm not your boss right now, so you can say whatever you want. We work together.
It doesn't make a difference in outcomes. It doesn't get you back to the hospital.
It doesn't.
I will go emergent to the hospital without lights and sirens and tell my driver to turn them on when we get off the exit.
Yes.
Good. Yes. Good.
So, pat yourself on the back.
As a sidebar to that, is I've also spent time on scenes with family and with firefighters who run lights because it looks better to the public.
Oh, yeah.
Explaining to the family, we're not going to turn on our lights for safety reasons, but we are going emergent so that they understand exactly what's going on and so that we have a more educated public too, you know?
All good points, Matt, and your boss is happy to hear you say that kind of stuff.
And I got a question for Dr. Ross. So, Dave, if you're wondering whether or not a paramedic really truly understood the potential lethality of a pathology with a patient they've got, is that one of the indicators that you're looking at, whether or not they back emergently or not with that patient?
Not for me personally, but I'm a little bit different. I am much more attuned to the risk of crash and the risk of injury and death associated with that. So my bias is to avoid lights and sirens if at all possible. And so I'm a little different in that regard than maybe than the average physician and maybe the average medic in that regard. So my bias is to avoid it completely, and I turn around and ask why. In fact, I was just at UPass Regional Ambulance today asking, and they have like a 1% lights and siren return to the hospital, so they're pretty darn low as it is. And I picked out a case that they did run lights and sirens, and we spent half an hour going over why it was they did go lights and sirens with it. And I'll tell you this, and there's more and more literature coming out, the mechanism deal, is what a lot of us have based, you know, our fears on, it not really surprisingly, doesn't pulled up to predict bad outcomes.
So I told you, Dave Ross, yeah, the best medical
doctor. You're exactly right.
I told you.
So you got a patient that's hemodynamically stable, but was ejected from a vehicle. Yeah, they have a big mechanism, and you do need to be worried about that. But if they're hemodynamically stable, the chances of them deteriorating while you have them, even in, you know, if it's a 30-minute transport, is extremely low. And so, you know, yes, it could happen, but is it likely to happen? No, it's not. So knowing that, and knowing there actually was a study in 1992 by a guy named Kupis looking at clinical outcomes. They actually correlated lights and sirens return and outcome before and after an education for their medics, and which they tried to reduce all of that, and they put out some clinical criteria and everything, and I won't go through all the details, but basically they were able to reduce their lights and sirens returns by about 92% with no difference in outcome. And in that paper, they also said that in their assessment, 95% of the patients coming to a hospital by EMS are the acute need for a transport to the hospital made no difference at all. In other words, it doesn't make any difference. And there's lots of reasons why people call an ambulance. There's social reasons. I can't get a ride. I'm drunk. You know, whatever. You know, there are lots of reasons. And some of them do need to be in the hospital, without a doubt. But do they make a difference? Is it a difference, you know, whether you're riding lights or sirens? No, it isn't. And that's my own personal observation with my own patients. You know, I see lots of ambulances coming into our hospital. The vast majority of them are not in any way time dependent. So you just have to understand that and accept that as being reality.
I appreciate that response, Dave. I think that you know, that there's a lot of things in what you said to consider.
Yeah, and this is a good time to mention that coming up next Friday, a week from tomorrow, on October 3rd, the state is hosting its first ever annual safety seminar. And that's going to be in Denver at the Crown Plaza Hotel in I-70 and Chambers. And we're bringing in lots of speakers locally and around the country. And the primary purpose is to actually look at safety equipment that the state may give preferential granting consideration to for the grants program. But there's going to be we're bringing in an insurance risk manager from Tomco Insurance, and he's got tons of statistics based on years and years of insuring EMS vehicles. And I think we're going to hear a lot of things nationally and look at literature that's out there. Most of this is equipment related, but there is a lot of information about loss related to crashes.
You saw the picture.
What's that?
Sorry, Dave.
Sorry, my mic was on and I saw the picture. I didn't mean to.
Dave, I sent a picture of a raccoon that Ben had sent me while we're chatting. Dave, it got denied by your server. But
well,
it's
and rightly so, Roger. It's
coming to you. Raccoon, I'm not responsible for it. Ben is, who's the silent participant.
I would like to see that, though.
I know. I'll try to get. I just want everybody to know that Ben is with us. Ben, say something.
Sorry, I've been relatively quiet tonight. I do have a question for the
peanut
gallery. If I can move over to the operational side of the lights and sirens thing, I've always kind of felt pretty strongly that if you're going to have the lights on, you should probably have the siren on too. And I've heard some arguments from people that, well, we just had the lights on for clearance, or so people knew we were kind of, you know, in a hurry, and things don't make a lot of sense to me. How do you guys feel?
Not required by state law. And
check your own state, though. Check your own state. That's Colorado.
In Colorado. I had an issue a long time ago in a volunteer agency I worked with, and it was a big to-do, and finally somebody looked it up, and you don't have to. You don't have to have both.
That was the change, because that changed 96 or 97, where it used to say lights and siren, and they changed it to lights or siren because the cops didn't want to use the siren when they were trying to sneak up on people. Be safe, everybody. I mean, don't get smoked doing this job. That's the I have taken care of a paramedic in the back of a rolled over ambulance, and it's not fun. So be safe, everybody.
Well, and I think the siren, the whole idea of a siren is it's good for intersections. It's good for coming up behind people sometimes. Most of the time, I find it really loud and annoying in the cab, and it's just that's just my personal experience that after a while, it's like, just turn the thing off because nobody pays attention to it, and the only thing it does is amp up the crew and make you annoyed and everything else on the way to the call. So, you know, you can blare your horn, and you can hit your air horn, and you can do all the good things, but...
I want to finish the topic, but I want to get in the last word, which would be my character.
Yeah.
Oh, hang on 1 second, then. Let me say something before you finish, Roger.
I was going to say, because Matt likes
you
to
can jump in. I'll say something later. But, okay. You know, I want to avoid going emergent with lights and sirens just because of the way it makes people drive crazy. It makes them crazy.
My favorite thing about going emergently is watching dogs howl along with the siren.
My dog Emma does that as the ambulances pass by. They go. She goes. Ooh.
Yeah, I think that's my favorite thing raccoons. Is watching dogs howl and rabid raccoons howl at the ambulance.
Well, let me just throw in one thing, and Roger, you can have it back to close it out. But as a non EMT or paramedic, and as just a most of the time just a regular old civilian driver, I'll just point out that, and I don't know if my ambulance crews or the fire department are trying to kill me or not, but when I've been out driving and I hear a siren, I have a tough time in today's vehicles to localize where it's coming from. And I can hear it, and that's assuming they're running it and not just going lights, but lights and sirens. You know, you can kind of hear it, but it's tough to pin down exactly where it's coming from.
And then comes the crazy driving. That's Dave, right. One of the crazy drivers.
That's how exactly. What I was going to say was the new cars are selling themselves on being soundproof. And when you get on the interstate out here with the speed limits at 75, you're out running your siren. So the only thing you're doing is adding anxiety to your patient and making crazy drivers.
Right. And I also point out just one part of our problem, although it's mostly an EMS issue, but part of our problem is the you know, when you're transferring a patient from a facility, you know, the doc or the nurse, unknowing of any of the issues, will say, well, you know, they got to go hot to wherever it is you're going. And so if you're a new EMT or a medic and you think, geez, well, they must know. They must know a lot more about the patient than I do. Yeah, okay, we're gonna go lights and sirens just because they said so in the emergency room or in the ICU. Sure. And I would advocate strongly that people think of your ambulance as a helicopter or an airplane. And, yeah. You know, if the clouds are low, it doesn't matter what's wrong with that patient. The pilot shouldn't be taking that airplane up. And the same is sort of true as an analogy with an ambulance. I mean, you've got to be able to stop and say, this patient looks clinically stable to me, and I'm responsible for that ambulance. And so, no, we're not going lights and sirens. And that takes a big chunk of some guts to do that. And it's my hope in the longer term we can educate our physicians through the medical society and the nurses to help us out with that.
Next
topic. I'm going to get the last word on this.
No,
one.
Next topic.
Yeah, oh, no, too late.
People are getting...
the other thing that I think is important that I think Dave kind of mildly hit on is that the driver... Okay, so as a paramedic in the back, I'm responsible for one patient. As the driver, I'm responsible for two people in the back, myself, and anybody else I might hit. So that just makes it all the more important that that driver is acutely aware of what's going on in the back. So anyway, last word. How about, let's talk about vehicle con... I can't say that. See, I there's words I can't say. Vehicle identification and how it looks with reflective versus not reflective. Conspicuity.
You have no idea how much grief I got last week.
I had lunch with boss the other day.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. So I need to put an apology to Fred Morrison and his
you
color
suck
scheme.
It up now. You're sucking up.
I am sucking up. I can't tell you what.
Will, tell us some of the things that the rest of the staff did.
Well, there was my office was not, contrary to rumor, was not painted in Eagle County Ambulance paint scheme. That was a horrible rumor, but I had about 50 pictures of white, yellow, orange, and red ambulances in my office.
I don't think it's red. Is it really red?
So it looks. It makes me see red. Maybe that's.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe that's why. Yeah.
Well, my apologies, Fred.
Well, it's it. Well, and I can call it hideous, but I don't think it was necessarily hideous. It was. It's not very flattering, but although it doesn't make
it's
me like want to. But it doesn't want to make me vomit like the what summit ambulances make me want to vomit.
Beautiful. It's a beautiful color ambulance. I love her.
Chris, Ben is really big and he could twist you into a pretzel.
That's okay. I'm not near him now, so it's all good. No, it's just something with that school bus. Oh, it's urine yellow is what we're going to call the summit ambulance. Along with that kind of green county logo. Oh god,
it's the teal that really sets you off.
Yeah, that's it. It's the teal with the school bus yellow.
Well, as they say in advertising, if it gets people talking, you made your point.
Or puking.
One.
There's no such thing as bad publicity.
Right. It's kind of like bad publicity is better than no publicity.
I think this is just some thinly veiled jealousy from our neighbors to the west.
Yeah,
there's a good possibility of that. Not at all. No, but I mean, okay, so let's talk about it.
Okay,
seriously.
We just went off on this whole thing. Be safe. I don't want any of you getting killed. Drive without lights and sirens. Drive slow. And then you see a very conspicuous paint color that's highly reflective, highly noticeable, that obviously is very emotion generating. And
it makes you want to vomit.
You're dissing it. Yeah. Yeah,
it makes you want to vomit.
So
I mean, you know, it's easy.
Hypocrite. Get consistent.
No, I mean, I think you can do it well, and you just don't do it well.
So, Roger, why did you guys pick the paint scheme that you did?
I'm not you guys. No. It's conspicuous, and if someone notices you, you're less likely to get hit, as the thinking goes. And as far as I'm concerned, I don't care what the thing looks like. If it reduces my odds of getting hit, it worked.
Now, there you go. I think you've hit the nail on the head that I was reading a few articles this week about it. And you know what's funny is that we identify ourselves so much by what's painted on the side of that billboard that we drive around.
Yeah, you'd and love it if it had a Nike swoosh on the side of it, wouldn't you?
No, I wouldn't. But what
you
I'm saying is...
Some.
But what I'm saying is that we get lost in the fact that it is a vehicle that sits on the side of a road or sits somewhere that it's probably gonna get hit, or it could get hit. So let's make it look ugly so nobody'll hit it.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, job done. Success rate.
I know.
I'm not taking any more grief from you guys.
Can I get a picture of it for the website?
Yes.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And how about Will?
I think the color schemes are still, you know, kind of an issue in debate, and I know we're going to be talking about that in part at the safety conference because it's really interesting stuff. The pictures that I've seen from ambulances in Europe tend to be kind of what I think Roger's describing, and they're white and yellow usually with kind of yellow lines, and you know, by our standards they might look pretty ugly, but at least in theory they're supposed to be more noticeable. I don't know how well proven that is, but there certainly may be something to it. The AMR ambulances and our teller ambulances are much more traditional, kind of red, white, blue, maybe some orange and blue, and so they don't really stand out as well.
Well, and I think that the research has shown that a single belt line with without the checkerboard, with a vehicle outline in high reflective white, and then some kind of rear marking with the that doesn't include an entire back of chevrons, but a small amount of chevrons, is what the standard is, at least in Australia, and that's some of the research that's coming out from them.
Yeah, that's where we got consulted on the choice of colors, and the layout and the design was the Australian guy, and I'm trying to look up his name right now. Sean contacted him directly and consulted with him extensively and decided on the color pattern based on their research.
Exactly, and that's, we actually stole that research for our most recent.
I'll defer to you guys. My specialty and my bailiwick is clinical stuff. Whatever, I don't have a dog in this fight.
Okay, well, and we actually stole that same study from Sean and took it a little bit more overboard than you guys did.
John Killeen.
Yes. Excellent, excellent paper. It was like 10 pages, that study.
Yeah.
And he did it for free.
And Chris, since I'm not familiar with that, maybe some of the listeners aren't, but you know, what was the upshot? What did they study and what they decide was a positive out of that?
Okay, well, some of the positives were that when you break up a vehicle with multiple lines, say you have a vehicle with a straight line and then all of a sudden you have an offshoot that goes up. I know our current ambulances have that. What it does to the person, say you see that vehicle driving by you in an intersection or something, your eye actually stops at the first place that the line breaks,
right,
and you don't see the rest of the vehicle. You don't see the rest of the emergency vehicle. So what they've found is a long straight stripe along a vehicle, and it can be multiple color, a la ECAD, which is, you know, they probably were, and I won't, you know, don't tell Fred this, but they probably were well ahead of their time when they saw the differences in the hues of the vehicle and looked at a long straight line, and that's all you need. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is they said that having chevrons on the entire back of the vehicle, there are many, many fire and EMS chiefs that will tell you that they bought a brand new vehicle, they put it out on the first day, and boom, it got rear-ended the very first day. And it's because what they did is they put chevrons on the entire back of it. And what they're finding is that people, as they're driving, they'll see the chevrons, but then they lose their depth perception. So they can't actually see.
Oops, oh, sorry.
Oh, wow. That's it. Thanks.
Give me a sec. Sorry.
So they can't actually see. Oh, man, that's weird. I'll cut that part out. Okay.
There.
So they can't actually see where they're going to stop and what they're going to run into. So what they're saying is, less chevrons, but have them, because what it does is chevron in most views and in just our human eye is danger. And so what we see in that is danger, so our natural reaction is to stop. So those are some of the outcomes of that study. And using that high-vis reflective stuff has been the key for that.
I see.
Okay, last topic, and then we'll wrap it up, because we are at an hour, and I'm trying to keep it at an hour. There will be some we'll cut out some of that stuff.
Hey, are you going to share any of our listener email with us? Any of that hate mail that you've gotten?
I've only gotten one, so we'll leave it. Well, one hate email.
It was the only email.
That's the only email I've got. You know, though, we do have a new email address, though. It's emsgarage@gmail.com. If you want to email us and tell us how much you like it, or you can comment on the website. Whatever.
I can't wait to hear what the listener mail was. We got to do that.
Dude, I will forward it to you. It's too long to read on the air.
Wow. give us a synopsis, Chris. We got to end the program with...
Pretty much that... I didn't introduce everybody the first time. The music sucked.
And
the topic sucked. It should have been only 30 minutes. And I said, well, you know, for me, I think an hour is about right, because boy, we don't even get warm. Well, we don't even we don't even get warmed up till 45 minutes in. So
that takes me about 45 minutes to drink a couple beers.
Listener, thank you for the email. We greatly appreciate it. If you have better music, you have rights to it, please send it to us, because we're limited by rights. And we're all opinionated. We need an hour to get our opinions in.
Whoa,
his your internet connection's really rough there, dude.
I'm just kidding. I am really stirring the pot so Chris can get some really good email this week.
Thanks. Hey, you know, though, we didn't get any email about the first week when we started talking about the trauma nurses. So I would expect that hopefully now the trauma nurses will go
back
and
listen
to the
first
episode.
They're still not listening,
Chris. Well, Chris, I was just going to say, at least at one time what that proves is you had one listener at least. So.
Yes.
That's right. Oh, and maybe you guys missed it. That's right. We did lose we are number like 95, 96 on the medical side of the iTunes store, so that's actually
how many total numbers are we competing against? Is there 100 in there?
There's 102. No, I don't know. But honestly, I don't know how big they
are. We have a 4-star review on iTunes, I believe.
I have a 3-star.
He gave it to himself. I'm sure.
No, it's from somebody we all know. So anyway, so Matt, do you have a website you want to plug? Devious.tv or something crazy like that?
DMF.com.
No. Like Devious.tv or something crazy like that?
Oh.
You know, my side gigs. I have the video company with Devious. Of course, I'm an arms dealer with AlpineArms.com.
Like arms like the ones on my arm, like on my shoulders, or ones that
just
I carry on my...
Just
okay, all right, never mind. Hey, Will, do you have anything you want to plug? Anything you're working on besides your baby?
No. Halloween due date, so we'll see what happens.
Oh, wait. I bet your favorite website right now is babiesrs.com.
No. You know what? We went to Babies R Us in Westminster totally sober, and I lasted about 12 minutes.
Oh, dude, that store, it kills me.
But what was amazing, how many people there thought I wanted to talk to them.
And I'm about you're having a baby too.
It doesn't mean that I want to have a conversation with you.
Oh my gosh.
you're gonna be getting hate mail now from Babies R Us.
No, you're gonna get hate mail from every parent ever.
Hey, we just want some email. It's good or bad. Okay, just
wait, was there a talk to me thing on my forehead?
Yeah, because you're pregnant, dude.
God. Can you tell me about your baby now?
It's Will, just wait at gmail.com, ladies and gentlemen.
Say it again.
I said it's emsgarage at gmail.com.
Good job. Hey, Ben, do you have anything you want to plug?
My usual blog that's getting up and going slowly, prehospitalblog.com. That'd be about it.
Sweet. Dr. Dave Ross, you're excellent. Thank you for joining us as well. You have so many things you do.
I don't want to distract our one listener by giving them other options. So you bet. I'm happy with just being here.
But you're on like EMS1.com and Gems.com,
and
I'll put all the links in the show notes. Sure. So that's good. Hey, thank you guys very much for talking to me this week, and you know, it was a great show, and man, I haven't laughed this hard in quite a while. So. It was really good. So join us next week. We'll hopefully come up with a topic. And
Ben promises to talk more next week. He's a hopefully. Super interesting guy.
That's right.
Got a great talking voice, if you didn't notice. I got to give a plug for Ben.
Yeah, I agree.
He's single as well. So if...
Hey, we could put your picture on the website.
Yeah, right next to the rabid raccoon.
Oh, I thought that was you.
That's gonna be my portrait on Skype now.
I won't be able to talk to you. It totally kills me.
Good night, everybody.
Oh, good night. Hey, next Thursday we'll do it again. We've stopped recording, so next Thursday we can do it again and just whatever.
Okay.
It was great, guys.
Good talking to you guys.
Thanks for letting me jump on this with you guys. I feel dumb with all of you guys on the phone, but thanks for letting me hop in.
I'm right there with you, Matt.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-b